I'm very glad to welcome our next guest to take a look at another way of doing a bailout that might actually help most people, working people, low-income people, instead of just those guys on Wall Street. And we have with us on the line Tom Hartman, who's a Project Censored award-winning New York Times best-selling author and host of the nationally syndicated daily progressive talk program on the Air America Radio Network. Tom Hartman's books include Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, and Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. Thank you for joining us today. Welcome, Tom Hartman.
Well, thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
Tom Hartman, you outline a fascinating idea entitled How Wall Street Can Bail Itself Out Without Destroying the Dollar. And you start out in this article on your website, tomhartman.com, describing Grover Norquist's famous statement that the goal of arch conservatives in the economy should be to shrink government down to the size that it can be drowned in a bathtub. That's not what, of course, the Paulson-Bush Republican bailout plan would do. It would be to blow up government, to double the size of the debt. That's just this year, not counting the future debt with interest with this $700 billion bailout. But you're proposing a possible bailout in a different way. How would you structure it? How might people think about structuring it differently that they might still have a prayer of asking their own congressmen to do if they call them this weekend?
Right. Well, first, let me suggest that this actually is part of the shrink government down to the point where you can drown in the bathtub strategy. David Stockman referred to it as starving the beast. And his suggestion, you know, keep in mind, when Ronald Reagan came into office, our national debt was less than $1 trillion. In the 8 years of his administration, Ronald Reagan, one president, ran up more debt than every president from George Washington to Jimmy Carter combined. Ronald Reagan borrowed more money in our names than was borrowed to fight World War II, World War I, the Spanish-American War, the Civil War, the Vietnam War, all of them combined. And Stockman was quite candid about the reason why. If he could run the government into terrible, terrible debt, eventually it would reach the point where the debt was so great and the servicing of that debt was so great. Right now we're spending $360 billion a year just on interest on the national debt. That's enough to fund a national health care program. That it would prevent liberals in Congress from doing things like creating a national health care program. And to that extent, they've been rather successful, as I just said. And add another $1 trillion to the debt, and the $700 billion bailout will certainly be at least $1.5 trillion with interest. And you effectively paralyze the next two or three or four presidents from being able to engage in any kind of social programs.
That said,
what do we do?
That said, and we just spoke with William Grider, who broke the story of how David Stockman, Reagan's budget director,
you know this stuff,
also grew disillusioned with supply side economics. David
right.
Stockman did eventually,
yeah.
And the budget deficits that the policy caused. Now he was also taken out for the woodshed for opening his mouth about that.
Right.
But let's take a look at what happened next, which was 8 years of Clinton administration, at least from 92 onward, after a little 4 year Bush senior administration in between Reagan and Clinton. Clinton actually used the financial markets to froth up a lot of bubbling wealth anyway. Not a hell of a lot trickled down to low-income people, maybe a little bit.
Yeah.
The next administration got out of it, but of course, as you just pointed out, did not have the funds that it would otherwise have to, say, provide, for example, things that are cheap by comparison to $700 billion, cheap things like national health insurance for everyone in the United States.
Right. Yeah, and for the record, you know, I consider the Clinton administration, although there were a few good things that Bill Clinton did, to be one of the most conservative administrations of the 20th century.
Why is that?
Because Bill Clinton campaigned in 1992 as a populist, and 2 weeks before he took office, they sat, Robert Rubin and Alan Greenspan famously sat him down and told him the facts of life, and he governed as a conservative. Dwight Eisenhower was more liberal than Bill Clinton in terms of economic policy. Dwight Eisenhower believed that having a top income tax rate of 91% was a good thing, and he aggressively defended it and kept it throughout his presidency. He thought that having strong Social Security was a good thing, and he aggressively defended it against conservatives in the House and Senate. Eisenhower even kicked around the idea of a national health insurance policy, although when Truman floated it in 47, or proposed it in 47, it had been so aggressively squashed that Eisenhower didn't think that it had a prayer coming out of his own party. But all of that aside, your original question, how can we finance this ourselves without destroying the dollar? My suggestion was very simple. Let Wall Street pay for its own bailout. The two benefits of this are, number one, it's Wall Street's dollars paying for it rather than taxpayer dollars paying for it. So it's not creating new debt. It's not adding to the debt burden of the United States. And therefore, it won't inflate the dollar or depreciate the dollar, number one. And number two, this is by, and the mechanism by which I'm suggesting we do this is securities, what's referred to in the UK as a turnover, which is their term for the sale of a product. We call it transfer. In the United States, it's called a securities transfer excise tax, or an STET. In Europe, and it's the securities turnover, excise tax. And in the UK right now, if you buy or sell a stock or a credit swap or any kind of derivative, any kind of financial market product, basically, you pay a 0.25% tax on that transaction. And we had this in the United States. We used it to fund the Spanish-American War. We used it to fund the Civil War. We used it to fund World War I and World War II. It was put back on the books in 1914. It was doubled in the 1930s by Franklin Roosevelt, up to a quarter of a point, which is what I'm suggesting right now. And it stayed there until 1966. And you know, it was eventually phased out in the 60s because the economy was, you know, doing really well, and it just didn't seem like we needed, you know, there was a lot of sentiment for doing away with all the old taxes. And this was part of, in fact, the Kennedy's proposal to consolidate the tax system and lower the top rate down to 71%, but close up all the loopholes. So by doing this, the benefits are twofold. Number one, the stock market itself literally is generating the money at a quarter of 1%, which is what the UK right now charges. We would generate $150 to $160 billion a year in revenue. So if the Treasury were to say, okay, we're going to create a $700 billion fund, and all of that money is going to be paid back by a STET, by the STET tax, then, you know, over the first 5 years, it's all paid back, you know. So, and after that, we can use it to fund a national health care system, which is what economist Dean Baker suggested a year ago that we do in a brilliant paper that he wrote suggesting that we institute a STET tax to pay for national health care. The second benefit is the one that back in 1936, in his seminal book on economics, John Maynard Keynes suggested, in advocating that the U.S. maintain the STET tax that Roosevelt that year had, or the year before, had doubled. He said that the benefit of this tax is not the revenue it generates, because back in those days, there wasn't anywhere near as much trading activity as there is now, and that tax was only generating a few hundred million dollars, you know, a year. He said the benefit of the tax is that it acts as, it introduces viscosity into the market. It makes the market a little more viscous, a little thicker, and makes people more prone to invest and less prone to speculate. And I don't think most Americans get it, that there's a difference between speculation and investment. Speculation is gambling, and it's fundamentally bad for our economy when it's done with our stock market. Investment is buying stock in a company with the expectation that the value of that company is going to go up over time because they've got a good product, a good service, and good management. And investment is a good thing. Investment is how we reward companies that are doing well and CEOs that are doing well. Speculation is where you go in and on margin using debt buy, say, over the course of 2 or 3 days, 1 million shares in a relatively small company or 1 billion shares in a large company. And everybody sees all that activity in the stock and goes, whoa, hey, that stock is going up, you know, or somebody's buying that stock. The price starts to rise. So you take the price of a stock from $70 to $80 over a 3-day period by buying that stock, and then you dump all of your stock, and everybody else is left holding the bag as the stock drops back down to $70, and you walk away with a big profit. That kind of thing happens every single day on Wall Street. We refer to it as market volatility. And that's something that should be discouraged. Well, a 0.25% tax introduces a small, very small, you know, for somebody with a 401k who is even, you know, every couple of months moving the stocks around in their 401k because they're watching, you know, Larry Kramer on TV or whatever. Over the course of a year, they may end up paying $100 on this tax. You know, I mean, we're talking not a lot of money. But for somebody who's moving billions or hundreds of billions of dollars around, it adds up pretty fast. And so,
and gee, maybe some of that money adding up pretty fast on a 0.25% tax on these speculative financial transactions, that might actually help pay off this $700 billion that otherwise the general public and low-income people will be burdened with for the next 10 years, and their families and their next generations and their children's children might actually keep having to pay off otherwise.
Yeah. You still there?
Still here. Yeah. Just wanted to point that out. Go ahead.
No, you're absolutely right. And there's one member of Congress, Congressman Peter DeFazio, from the Democrat from Oregon, who has been championing this for some time and pointing this out. And I should have acknowledged him in the article. In fact, after I sent it off, I thought, damn, I wish I had done that because, you know, I wanted to, you know, people to get in touch with him. But members of Congress know him, and they know that he's been pushing for this.
Go ahead. Mention his name again, because people might be calling Congress.
Yeah, it's Peter DeFazio, and he's a great guy. It's D-I-F-A-Z-I-O, and I think their website is defazio.house.gov. I mean, that's the format that most of them use. Although I looked at his webpage a couple days ago, and there wasn't anything about this specifically on his homepage. There may be now. But the bottom line is, if you can ask your member of Congress to talk to Peter DeFazio, Peter will, you know, he's a real expert on this stuff, and he's got it down. And it's just a very simple, straightforward solution that A, doesn't depreciate the dollar, because we're not over the short term we'd have to increase our debt a little bit, but it would be paid back. It would be a known payback, right? So it's not going to destroy the dollar the way adding another $1 trillion of debt with no mechanism for paying it back. We're going to have to borrow it from the Chinese forever, and our grandchildren will have to pay it back. That seems crazy to me. And in that regard, I agree with the House conservative Republicans, right? Me, the great liberal. So number one, it doesn't depreciate our currency. Number two, it encourages investment rather than speculation. It rewards investment and punishes, very slightly, but it punishes speculation. And number three, it generates revenue over the long term that will certainly be well in excess of that needed for the bailout, which can be used for other things.
Tom Hartman is our guest. If you're just joining us, he is a Project Censored award-winning New York Times best-selling author and hosts the nationally syndicated daily progressive talk program on the Air America Radio Network. TomHartman.com is the website. Tom Hartman, I want to ask you particularly, like, a little bit more about this Congressman Peter DeFazio in the House of Representatives, particularly if you could describe, he's been one of the people to propose this particular tiny, tiny tax, 0.25% on these major billion-dollar financial transactions. Some of them are only multi-million-dollar financial transactions. But he may not be advancing that in Congress today. He may be under a lot of pressure, like a lot of Democrats are, to play ball here with the Bush-Paulson Republican-backed plan. It's an odd political situation. I think a lot of Democrats in Congress are under heavy-duty pressure. They're knuckling under to people who have donated to their campaigns for decades in multiple re-election runs, and that is the financial industry, the financial services industry, precisely the guys in ties you're watching giving congressional testimony, begging for the $700 billion. Of course, in a very gentlemanly way. They would never be seen on television begging, but effectively that's what they're doing. Some describe it as putting a gun on the table and politely saying $700 billion, please, otherwise the economy is grinding to a halt. Some people say there may be only a few days left, a week left, before people can't get small loans to pay their own employees if you own a small business. I wonder specifically what you think of the Democratic Party collusion in passing a $700 billion bailout and only making a few little demands, a few little conditions that it's going to be very easy for Secretary Paulson to concede to, like, oh, okay, a few caps on CEO pay, but not for all CEOs, not a ratio of worker to CEO pay for all companies in America. No, just the ones that are going to get help from the bailout. A few things like that, maybe a little help for mortgage holders, but not very much else.
Yeah. Well, first, you know, let me tell you the image that comes to mind for me, and I think may well for people who are like me, old enough to remember the movie Blazing Saddles, is that moment where Cleavon Little, who's playing the sheriff, this black guy who's playing the sheriff, you know, the mob is coming at him when they discover that their new sheriff is a black guy, and he's like, oh, I got to get out of here. So he grabs his own gun, sticks it to his own head, and says, get any closer and I'll shoot the black guy. You know, I mean, his language is actually a little more explicit than that, but that's what Paulson's doing. He's putting a gun to his own head and saying, you know, if you don't do what I want, I'll shoot. And it's crazy. It's kind of pathetic. And to show how pathetic it is, for example, in this compromise, everybody's saying, well, they're putting limits on executive pay. They're not. What they're doing is they're putting limits on the tax deductibility to the corporation of executive pay. Right now, there is a maximum amount of $1 million that a corporation can deduct in the salaries to their CEOs. It used to be unlimited, and back during the Clinton administration, they put on this $1 million cap in order to try to keep down executive pay. So what did the corporations do? They started paying all their executives $1 million because that was tax deductible to the corporation. And then rather than giving them an additional $14 million in cash, they give them the $14 million in stock. The executives turn around and sell the stock, a week later, a month later, a year later, claim a capital gain on it. Capital gains are only taxed at 15% now under the first Bush tax cut instead of at the full 35% rate that you and I would pay if we had income. And they're making out like bandits. So, I mean, it's not even a cap on executive pay. It's just a cap under the deductibility of the, they're saying you can only deduct the first $440,000 or $420,000 or whatever the president's salary is right now. And it's a joke. So, I haven't done any kind of a census of members of Congress, and I frankly haven't discussed this with Congressman DeFazio at all. He was on my peer, Carl Wolfson, does the morning show here in Portland, Oregon, and of course Peter DeFazio represents Oregon, and Congressman DeFazio was on Carl's show talking about this, and that's how I got it, that he's figured this thing out. But it was Dean Baker, the economist, who's a very serious and brilliant economist, who's written several great books on economics that you can easily Google or track down. Dean Baker, like I said, first seriously suggested this about a year ago, but this is before there was a crisis as a way to pay for national health care. Bernie Sanders, I talked to Bernie Sanders on Friday. He's a senator from Vermont. He's been proposing that essentially, again, the rich pay to bail out the rich, that everybody in America who has an income of over $1 million a year pay a 10% surcharge or a surtax, which, by the way, would just take them back to where they were under the Clinton administration, more or less. I mean, it would basically repeal the Bush tax cuts for people making over $1 million. And because the top 400 individuals in the United States, the top 400 people in the United States during the last 7 years have increased their income by almost $700 billion as a result, by and large, of Bush tax policies. And they've increased their net wealth by over $1 trillion. So, Bernie's saying, it's like, not Dillinger, whoever the bank robber was, he said, they asked him, why do you rob banks? He says, because that's where the money is. So Bernie's saying, let's tax the rich because they're the ones who are engaged in most of this activity and benefiting from it.
Tom Hartman, I apologize for having to interrupt you there. I wish we had more time. I'll encourage people to check out your radio program on the Air America Radio Network, which they can find partly online and in other cities around the country. Tom Hartman is Project Censored award-winning and New York Times best-selling author, hosts the nationally syndicated Daily Progressive Talk program, The Tom Hartman Show, on the Air America Radio Network. You can find Tom's article we are discussing today, How Wall Street Can Bail Itself Out Without Destroying the Dollar, on his website, tomhartman.com. That's spelled TOMHARTMANN.com. Tom Hartman, thank you very much for joining us in Sounds of Dissent.
Thanks so much. It's been an honor to be here.